Without objection, so ordered.
I thank the gentleman for yielding, and let me begin by concurring with a portion of what the distinguished majority leader has just said. Mr. Speaker, it is terribly important that in the last moments of this debate, we do not reduce this magnificent exercise in free speech to some kind of inarticulate, indecisive mumble, which sends no clear message of American resolve. However, if we reject Solars Michael and pass Gephardt Hamilton, or worse, if we pass them both, we may preach diplomacy, but we will practice delay, and we will give Saddam Hussein the one commodity that he needs to prevail. That's time. A two-month delay will allow him to manipulate the Islamic holy month of Ramadan against our Arab allies in the coalition. A six-month delay will force our U.S. commanders to decide between combat readiness and troop rotation. A delay of 1 year might force this body back into session to decide whether we need to reinstitute a military draft to maintain our own commitment. And while we labor under these decisions, Saddam, confident that he will not be struck at massively and decisively at a point uncertain, will no doubt refresh and rest his troops, stockpile his spare parts, deprive his citizens to feed his soldiers, and no doubt work out the kinks in his chemical weapons. And I cannot even begin to speculate at what the luxury of time will do for his ability to export terrorism around the region, which he has vowed to do. Now, perhaps because I have just returned from the Gulf, I do not, as many of you do, feel very optimistic that conflict is avoidable. But I will oppose Gephardt Hamilton because I still want to extend diplomacy and not extinguish it. But what chance does Perez de Cuellar or the European foreign ministers or even those Arab ministers that are proposing diplomatic solutions have to realize their goal? If force is not a constant alternative to Saddam's intransigence, we naively presume in this body that somehow this man is impressed by our tightly reasoned, diplomatically appropriate Western civilization arguments. But what model does he have for democracy? Egypt, a country he has already betrayed by going into Kuwait? Israel, a country that he has vowed to obliterate? And what is his model for Arab moderation and peaceful coexistence? Anwar Sadat, now deceased. Ladies and gentlemen, from his narrow frame of reference, we can really only teach Saddam Hussein two lessons. We can teach him the lesson of Lebanon, in which American resolve collapsed under third world terrorism, or we can teach him the lesson of Libya, in which the terrorist Gaddafi himself finally paid the price for his brutality. Now, I know which lesson this gentleman will prefer to teach. And yes, I have been with the congressional delegation most recently and heard the reports the Arabs will not fight. I have heard that report. For what it's worth, I have also heard our distinguished majority whip say that conflict is inevitable and the sanctions will take 2 or 3 years. But I respect his decision. But I ask you to respect this. I ask you to reject the Gephardt solution and rally instead behind the resolve and the clear-headed determination of a young soldier who said to us when we were in Saudi Arabia last week, he said, "Congressman, I really want to go home. But I want to go home through Kuwait. Support Solars."
Donors recognized.
Mr. Speaker, I rise in support of the Michael Solars resolution and in opposition to the resolution offered by my dear friend, Mr. Gephardt and Mr. Hamilton. I urge my colleagues to vote like. I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks.
Without objection, so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, for purposes of a unanimous consent request, I recognize the gentleman from Kansas, Mr. Glickman.
Speaker, from Kansas.
I rise in support of the Solars-Michael Amendment. I believe, with a great deal of reluctance, that diplomacy is best disturbed by the threat of imminent military power. For that reason, I reluctantly oppose the amendment of my colleague, Mr. Gephardt. I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks.
No objection, so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, I yield myself the balance of the time.
Recognized. 5 minutes.
And now, my friends, a great choice. Not only a question of war. In truth, that judgment remains with Saddam Hussein. He shall withdraw from Kuwait and the peace shall be preserved. For he shall remain. And at some point on some battlefield with some unspoken weapon, war will be fought. The issue for us is also how to preserve the peace, even at this late moment. The Hamilton Resolution asks you to believe that an adolescent assassin who rose to power assassinating his closest friends and allies, who sent 1 million men to their death in the war with Iran, who visited upon his people 8 years of unspoken deprivation, that this man will respond to your patience because of his deep and abiding concern for his people. It is, my friends, a triumph of hope over reason. 400,000 young Americans are on station in Saudi Arabia, the most powerful army in history. And still Saddam defies the world's demand for justice. He does not doubt our power. He doesn't question our weapons. He doubts our will. He challenges the proposition that our generation possesses the strength of purpose, the basic resolve of our fathers. My friends, send Saddam a message that will shake the foundations of Baghdad, that the American people are filled with a terrible resolve, angered that at this moment in history, still in the dawn of our triumph over communism, believing that the peace was secured for our generation, that he has brought the world war again. Resolve that international law in our time will have meaning, that the ambitions of Wilson and Roosevelt for order among nations, a time when the weak would be protected, there would be order among the strong, would be known. America, I know you're tired. We are so few, and we have borne the burdens of this world for so long. But history calls us again. George Bush has assembled what is arguably the greatest coalition of nations of all time. United not for the conquest of anyone, with designs on nothing but for justice and for a lasting peace in a new time. That coalition is tested in a defining moment of the post-Cold War period that will tell much about the role of our nation for the rest of our lives and the kind of peace that may endure. This is the issue. I have lived through my life, my 39 years, with 200 wars. My greatest hope for our time is that the future be made different from the past. That is what we ask. 160 nations have spoken. The Security Council has voted. The Senate of the United States has decided. And now the world watches this house. Is our resolve less? Our vision any different? Give an answer that will be heard not simply throughout the world, but throughout the years. A message that every despot and dictator in every corner of this globe will hear. It is a new time of international law with real international sanctions for those who would violate the peace. Mr. Speaker, we are a patient people. But we shall not visit this moment in our history again. This international coalition will not endure if the wrong judgment is made here today. gift of time that you would give Saddam shall not be used for peace. God, I wish that it were so. But to prepare for war, to build the trenches, to provide the traps, to refine the weapons that would consume the lives of our sons and daughters. An hour ago, we declared that we would use our constitutional prerogative. Now is that time. Stand with your president without division. God bless you as you make your fateful choice. And to those young Americans in foxholes and tents spread across the broad peninsula of Arabia, as you listen to our words here today, know that we are proud of you. We are grateful to you. And Godspeed in your mission for America and for a lasting peace.
Speaker, I ask, I now recognize the gentleman from Hawaii, Mr. Abercrombie, for unanimous consent.
Objection, so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, I request permission to revise and extend these remarks. Mr. Speaker, speaking for 17 members of the class of 1990 in support of the Hamilton-Gephardt resolution, we believe that the alternatives to war have not been exhausted. We will not vote for a declaration of war in the Persian Gulf. We call on our colleagues to exhaust all efforts to secure peace in the area by voting for the Hamilton-Gephardt resolution.
Objection to order.
Mr. Speaker, I yield the gentleman from Colorado, Mr. Skaggs, for unanimous consent request.
Gentleman from Colorado.
Mr. Speaker, I endorse prayerfully the course which Mr. Gephardt and Mr. Hamilton's resolution would put this country on and ask leave to extend my remarks at this point.
Objection to order.
Mr. Speaker, I recognize the gentleman from California, Mr. Torres, for a unanimous consent request.
Without objection,
Mr. Speaker,
order.
I rise to express the overwhelming sentiments of the people, the American people of my congressional district, who have implored upon me on behalf of their sons and daughters to support the Hamilton-Gephardt resolution. And I ask unanimous consent to extend and revise my remarks.
Without objection, so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, I yield the gentleman from Idaho, Mr. Stallings, for unanimous consent request.
Gentleman from Idaho.
Speaker, I rise in support of the resolution. Ask unanimous consent to revise.
Without objection, so ordered.
Speaker, I recognize the gentleman from Kentucky, Mr. Mazzoli, for a unanimous consent request.
Gentleman from Kentucky.
Mr. Speaker, I rise in proud support of the Gephardt-Hamilton resolution and in opposition to the Solars-Michael resolution. Ask unanimous consent to revise.
Without objection, so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, I recognize the gentleman from Mississippi, Mr. Espy, for a unanimous consent request.
Gentleman from Mississippi.
Thank you, Majority Leader. Mr. Speaker, I don't believe in death by deadline. I believe that there are other alternatives that are viable left to us before we turn this great country to war. Therefore, after a lot of soul searching, I announce my support in favor of Hamilton Gephardt and ask unanimous consent to revise and send my remarks on behalf of the Senate at this point in the record.
Mr. Speaker, I now recognize Ms. Slaughter from New York for a unanimous consent request.
Gentlewoman from New York.
Mr. Speaker, because I believe with all my heart that it is the best course for the United States of America, I support the Hamilton-Gephardt resolution and ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks.
No objection, so ordered.
The gentleman yield for unanimous consent request.
I just have one more. Ms. Speaker, I recognize the gentleman from New York, Mr. Flake, for a unanimous consent request.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On behalf of the physical and emotionally scarred Vietnam veterans who have contacted me and the potential physically and emotionally scarred casualties of the Desert Shield, I rise in support of the Gephardt-Hamilton resolution and ask unanimous consent to extend and revise.
No objection, sir.
Mr. Speaker, I recognize the gentleman from Michigan, Mr. Carr, for unanimous consent request.
Mr. Speaker, President George Bush has my prayers. Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Gephardt have my vote. I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend.
Without objection, so ordered.
I yield the gentleman for unanimous consent.
A proud moment for the House. Debate excellent on both sides, Mr. Leader. And I ask unanimous consent to insert a statement on terrorism. With each passing day, Saddam Hussein grows stronger in the field of terrorism and prepositions more weapons of horror worldwide. Thank you.
Not about a lack of determination to see Saddam Hussein, a brutal dictator who has taken a country by force and violence and holds it today, allowed to stay. We will not permit that. This country is committed to his removal from Kuwait. It is not about who supports the President of the United States and who does not. I honor and respect the President. I know his determination, and I also know, as each of us knows, the awful loneliness and terrible consequence of the decisions that he must make as president. Jefferson was written a letter by Madison, who told Jefferson that the Constitution recognizes what all history shows, that it is the executive branch that is more interested in war and more prone to it. And therefore, it has reposed the decision on war to the legislature. I do not believe that the president wants war. I believe that he devoutly wishes peace and hopes it works and will continue to hope and work for it. But it is wrong to suggest that we who have taken our own oath and responsibility can burden him further by giving him the responsibility that must be ours today. We must share in this responsibility. We have been elected to do it. The Constitution mandates it. And we would shirk our responsibility if we say in easy acquiescence, we'll just let the president decide. That is unfair to him, as it is to our constituents and to our responsibility. He deserves more than any single person in this country, not just our agreement, given casually or automatically, but our informed and conscientious judgment. And each member should strive to give that to the president and the country today. It is not about who supports our troops. We hear constant references that they are eager, almost anxious, to fight and to sacrifice and perhaps to die. And I must say a respectful thank God. Thank God we have young men and women who are committed to this country and to its values and to its service, that they are ready to lay down their very lives for it and for their fellow citizens. That is a tremendous gift to this country. And each of us who has seen our troops in the field, our young men and women, and noted their morale and enthusiasm, and as I say, even eagerness, has a duty to them, not just to respect it and to thank them for it, but not to rush them into an early and precipitate war as a way of recognizing that sacrifice, that potential, and that willingness. It is not about supporting the coalition that the president has so successfully organized. It is not about supporting the United Nations that has a new and revived role in moving forward with international order. It is not about standing with our allies. All of those things can be done in support of the Hamilton-Gephardt resolution. It is not about using force. Force is being used every day. Ships are being stopped. Iraq is being surrounded. Its military potential has been hedged. We are in a position constantly to reserve the right to give the final approval to the president to use the maximum force in our command, a terrible, terrible force that this country has the power to inflict. 8 years ago, in the 98th Congress, this House was asked to adopt a resolution providing for the continued peacekeeping presence of U.S. Marines and other servicemen in Lebanon. The Speaker of the House, Thomas P. O'Neill, took the well and asked for the support of all members in the President's request that we should continue American peacekeeping presence in Lebanon. I voted for that resolution, and I regret it today. Not because one could not honorably support such a resolution. Not because I wanted to back the president or I wanted to stand firm with the leadership on both sides of the aisle. Those are all decent reasons. It is I regret it today, not just because, as we all regret, over 300 Marines lost their lives. I regret it today because I took that vote feeling doubtful, uncertain, unwilling to commit myself fully to its consequence. And those who believe that the president must now be armed with what is unquestionably, as Dante Bissell, so honorably candid as always, has told this House, is the virtual declaration of war, those who believe that that must be done should not hesitate to vote that way, should not hesitate to give him that power. But let me suggest to you one thing. Do not do it under the notion that you merely hand him another diplomatic tool, another quiver of economic leverage or international leverage. The president has had no doubt about this. He has said it again and again, that if given that power, he may well use it, and perhaps sooner than we realize. If that is your judgment, vote honorably and calmly and securely. But if you feel that more can be done, if you feel that the sanctions have not yet wasted their opportunity, if you believe that Saddam Hussein is growing weaker every day under their impression, if you believe the international coalition will hold, if you believe that this nation's leadership is best expressed in this body and in the other body and in the coalition of constitutional consent, then vote for Hamilton Gephardt. But however you vote, as the majority leader has said, let us come together after the vote with the notion that we are Americans here, not Democrats and not Republicans, all anxious to do the best for our country without recrimination as the motive, without anything but the solemn pride that on this great decision day, we voted as our conscience and judgment told us we should. And then, though our opinion may change over years, we will not bear the burden of a harsh judgment on our honor and our actions at this moment. And as we debate, I too, though I was raised in a tradition that said, pray silently and privately, offer a public prayer for this House, for all of us, for the Congress, for our president, and he is our president, and for the American people, and particularly those young Americans who stand willing to make the supreme sacrifice. May God bless us and guide us and help us in the fateful days that lie ahead. Mr. Speaker, I yield the floor.
Mr. Speaker and my colleagues, we have come to the closing moments of a long and a wrenching debate. For the past 48 hours, the media have carried our deliberations live, gavel to gavel, into millions of our homes. Calls have been jamming the Capitol switchboard. America, indeed the world, is watching. We are about to cast what so many members have acknowledged may be the most important vote of our lives, whether or not to go to war. And make no mistake about it, this resolution is tantamount to a declaration of war. Before we cast this vote, each of us has to ask ourselves, do we really have no other choice? War is the least predictable and the most painful of our options, and it must be the very, very last resort. We support the goals of the president's policy, and Saddam Hussein must know that this country is united against his aggression and determined that he will leave Kuwait. We support the deployment of troops to enforce the sanctions and to maintain international pressure. But the January 15th deadline is arbitrary. It is unrealistic. The sanctions against Iraq are working, and now is too soon to declare this policy a failure and to rush to war. Picture this. As we speak, over 1 million men and women face each other in the open desert and on the open seas. All the firepower of modern weaponry is ready to be unleashed. The cost in human lives could be enormous.
There are those who believe a war in the Gulf will be a short war, that the casualties will be few, and that the consequences contained, controlled. But there are no short or easy wars. In fact, no war is ever really over. And for some men and women, war is an eternity. Ask the families and the friends and the veterans of our last war. Their lives were forever changed. America has over 400,000 men and women on the front line, and we're proud of them, and we stand behind them 100%. But the best way to support them is to make sure that we do not ask them to make the ultimate sacrifice unless it is absolutely necessary. Can we really say this afternoon to those men and women in the desert that we have really given diplomacy a full chance? Will we just cast aside the testimony of Admiral Crowe and General Jones? Will we ignore the advice of 6 out of the last 7 secretaries of defense, all of whom...
We break away from Representative Bonnier for a moment. This helicopter, of course, is on the White House lawn. President Bush arriving back to the White House from Camp David. He will be holding a press conference after the House vote on the war resolution. So he should be getting to the White House any minute. The helicopter is setting down. We will continue with the debate on the House floor. And we want to remind you, too, at 6:30 Eastern Time, King Hussein will be interviewed on Evans and Novak on CNN. That's 6:30 Eastern on CNN.
And with its passage, the road to war opens before us. Nearly a generation ago, we sent hundreds of thousands of our young to fight a war that nobody wanted, in a land we didn't know, against a foe we did not understand. And we made the grave mistake at that time of failing to separate the war from the warrior. Well, to the men and women who carry our flag in the Persian Gulf today and in the weeks and the months ahead, let me say to you, we will not make the same mistake twice. You are our own. We draw strength from your courage, and we will stand by you regardless of how we cast our vote today. To each of my colleagues that are in the chamber here now today, let me appeal to you one more time to pause before you cast this vote and to ask yourself the same question that hundreds of American families are asking themselves today. Is this the time? And is this the cause for which you would risk and ask your son and daughter to risk their life? I urge you to vote against this resolution.
All time for debate has expired. Under the rule...
Mr. Speaker.
The gentleman from New York has time remaining.
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, let me yield at this time to the gentleman from Georgia, Mr. Rowland, for a unanimous consent request.
Speaker, I rise in support of Sol House and ask unanimous consent to revise the
objection, so ordered.
Speaker, I also yield to the gentleman from New Jersey, Mr. Hughes, for unanimous consent.
I thank the gentleman for yielding. Mr. Speaker, I rise in support of the Solar Michael Amendment because I'm persuaded that you don't advance a cause for peace by undercutting the president or repudiating UN Resolution 678. You advance it by strengthening the president's hand. Ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my report.
Without objection, so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, I yield myself the balance of my time.
The gentleman of New York is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, as we come to the close of this historic debate, I find myself in a somewhat
anomalous position. It was almost 25 years ago that I got my start in politics as the campaign manager for one of the first anti-war candidates for Congress in the country. It never occurred to me then that I would be speaking on the floor of the House of Representatives a quarter of a century later in support of a bipartisan resolution that many whom I respect fear could lead to another Vietnam. Yet I believe there are some fundamental differences between the situation in which we found ourselves in Vietnam then and the situation we confront in the Persian Gulf today. In Vietnam, vital American interests were never at stake. In the Gulf, they are. In Vietnam, the cost in blood and treasure was out of all proportion to the expected benefits of a successful defense of South Vietnam. In the Gulf, the enormous benefits of a successful effort to get Iraq out of Kuwait far exceed the admitted price we will have to pay if force must be used. We've heard a lot of talk in this debate about the need for patience. We were patient when Japan invaded Manchuria in 1931. We were patient when Italy attacked Ethiopia in 1936. We were patient when Germany blitzkrieged Poland in 1939. We were patient when Germany overran France in 1940. We were patient, Mr. Speaker, right up to December 7, 1941, when Japan attacked us at Pearl Harbor, by which time Germany had conquered almost all of Europe and Japan controlled much of Asia. The great lesson of our time is that evil still exists. And when evil is on the march, it must be confronted in the Persian Gulf. In the Persian Gulf, almost half a year after the brutal and unprovoked annexation of Kuwait, the time for patience has ended and the time for firmness has arrived. Saddam Hussein represents a clear and present danger, not only to the region, but to the world. He has gone to war twice in the last 10 years. He has used chemical weapons not only against his enemies, but against his own people. And he is well on his way toward acquiring nuclear weapons as well. Driven by a megalomaniacal lust for power, he is determined to dominate the entire Middle East. And if he is not stopped now, we will only have to stop him later, under circumstances where he will be much more difficult and much more dangerous to contain. None of us wants war. Yet the truth is that not until Saddam Hussein is stripped of any lingering illusions he may have about our willingness to use force, will there be any real chance of a peaceful resolution of this crisis. And that is why, with only 3 days left before the expiration of the UN deadline, this bipartisan resolution, by confronting Saddam Hussein with a choice between leaving and living or staying and dying, represents the last best chance for peace. The vote on the Gephardt-Hamilton resolution a short while ago demonstrates that a majority of the House believes that the protracted application of sanctions is a formula for failure rather than a strategy for success. Judge Webster, the head of the CIA, doesn't believe the sanctions will be sufficient to get Iraq out of Kuwait. Not the British, not the French, not the Egyptians, not the Saudis, not one of our coalition partners believes that sanctions will be sufficient to get Iraq out of Kuwait. And the reason they don't believe it will be sufficient is because they know that Saddam Hussein doesn't give a whit for the welfare of his own people. All he cares about is the maximization of his own power. And however great the economic impact of the sanctions may be, they know, as we know, that Saddam Hussein doesn't have to run for re-election in 1992. He doesn't have to worry about a contentious Congress or a critical press. He will hunker down. He will wait. And while he waits, there is a very real possibility that this inherently fractious and fragile coalition will begin to unravel and the sanctions will erode and he will prevail. With the adoption of the bipartisan resolution, however, we should be in a position to achieve our objectives by peaceful means if possible, but yes, by the use of force if necessary. And if we prevail, as surely we will have prevented a brutal dictator from getting his hands on the economic jugular of the world. We will have protected and stabilized the Arab governments courageous enough to have opposed him. We will have eliminated his weapons of mass destruction and greatly reduced his conventional military power. We will have enhanced the prospects for progress in the peace process between Israel and its Arab neighbors. And perhaps most importantly of all, by demonstrating that aggression does not pay and that the international community will uphold the sanctity of existing borders, we will have established a precedent that just could lead to the creation of a new world order governed by the rule of law rather than by the law of the jungle, and in which nations shall not make war against other nations anymore. Mr. Speaker, I urge the adoption of the bipartisan resolution.
Time for debate has expired. Under the rule, the previous question is ordered. Question is on engrossment in third reading. All those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, no. Opinion of the chair of the ayes have it. Third reading of the bill.
Joint resolution to authorize the use of United States Armed Forces pursuant to United Nations Security Council Resolution 678.
Question is on passage of the bill, on passage of the joint resolution. All those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, no.